Welcome, everybody, to the next in our series, The Leadership Hikers. I'm Joanna Bircher, and I'm a GP in Greater Manchester. Together with my colleague, Dr. Amal Raghani, who's a retired GP from Sheffield, we're talking with people, mainly from primary care, who've inspired us with their stories of what they care about and how they've helped to make life better and for their communities and through their leadership. We've written about what it takes to lead well in our book, The Leadership Hike, and this series is all about the people who do it. The people we call the leadership hikers. It's about what they've learned and what we might do too. So today I'm really delighted to welcome the next of our hikers, Dr. Austin O'Carroll. Austin is a GP working in Dublin. He's the founder of the North Dublin GP Training Scheme, which trains GPs specifically to work with marginalised people. He's the founder of Safety Net and the founder of Granby Clinic for Marginalised People, and also GP Care for All. In 2020, he was awarded Wonka Europe GP of the Year. So we are absolutely thrilled that he's been able to join us today to share his story and his tips. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Joanna.
How did you come to take on a leadership role in primary care in the first place?
I'm going to go back to when I was in the Cub Scouts, because it's bring it back to the subject of hiking. I remember being appointed a patrol leader in the Cub Scouts, and that was probably my first experience. And then, of course, I went on to the Scouts and I became a patrol leader there. And, you know, it's funny, what leads you to become a leader? I don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, people put me into that position. Like, as the patrol leader, you're appointed. And why was I there? I don't know. Then when I went on to university, I ended up, say, getting very involved with the Vincent de Paul. And I think... like I was never really appointed a leader. No one gave me that role in terms of, you know, I was never said, here, you are the leader of this. Like when I eventually came into general practice, I was things that interested me. So for example, when I was in college, I was very involved in working with Vincent de Paul inside inner city Dublin. And that gave me a real passion. I really loved people. I started to really love working with those people. I had great respect for them. They're great crack. They've been through an awful lot, and yet they survived. I was with them, working with them for many years. And then when I left college, I got involved in the disability rights movement. So I had a passion for working with people in deprivation and marginalization, and the disability rights movement only gave me a passion for a rights-based approach. So when I came working in inner city Dublin, like I literally arrived with myself and one receptionist into an area where I was attending a funeral of a young person every month, and I was meeting families where three or four kids had died from drug addiction or accidents. And it's just, you know, I had to respond. And so I suppose early on, I decided to make myself a clear vision and mission that I was going to address marginalisation. I remember making that decision in 98, and we actually buttered up as a practice vision and mission. And I suppose that's what led me into leadership, because then I was looking for ways to respond. So I started to develop the practice. That's the first thing I did to develop. And in developing the practice, I had to get other doctors and staff. But in getting them, I had to inculcate them into the same vision and mission. And I also had to equip them with the skills to, for example, you're dealing with people with drug addiction who can be aggressive. So it's one to manage drug addiction, but two is to manage the behaviours. And that's about the skills to manage those behaviours, along with, you know, the values that they want to help these people. So then you move on to the next thing. I started working, get involved with asylum seekers first. And then I had to develop a service for asylum seekers. Then I went on to developing service for homeless. So it's all just sort of, you're responding to each need, but it was all driven by that original vision and mission. Am I making sense in answering this?
Yeah, completely. I know. I wanted to pick up on the vision and mission thing. So we talk in the Leadership Hike book about how different things motivate different people. So people are driven to perform or to go to work for a whole range of different reasons. And I sometimes worry that it's a bit overambitious to think that people that we work with will all share our vision and our mission. And I just wondered whether you've encountered that and how you rise to that when that occurs.
Well, first of all, is I think you know, there's your own team. And one thing I think is important in the team I originally started with and I still have with me in my original practice is that a lot of them came from the area. So, you know, they automatically bought into the vision and mission because it was their friends, their colleagues. So like my receptionists all came from the local area. So that was the, you know, that was almost an easy win. And then the doctors, I suppose when I was going to interview doctors to work with me or nurses, I was, one of the big things I was looking for is, are you happy to work in this area? So we didn't hide the difficulties we had, but then we talked about, we really think we're making a difference. So, you know, I think people then who didn't want to work you with these people would know instantly not to apply. Then you come across the issue that you get staff members who you suddenly realize you made a mistake and they're not the people. And I do think one of your roles as a leader is to get those, you have to basically get those people out of the team because they will disrupt the team and they will affect your vision and mission. And I mean, I've had people and there's been difficult times. That's one of the difficulties of a leader is facing is that you have to move on someone who doesn't fit what you're doing. But if you do that, you reap the rewards, because I would say now, like I could think of six people definitely that I definitely had to move on. But now at this stage, I have a team and everyone is in harmony. Everyone is working with the same vision and mission. And you get to a stage, like I feel I'm at a stage where I don't go out and search for people. I'm approached by people who want to work in the practice. So I don't have an issue now getting suitable people. It's almost, you know, I'm almost saying no to good people at the moment. So, but there was a lot of hard work to develop that in the first place.
It's a really it's a challenging part of leadership, the concept that you might have to make a tough decision about one of your team members because they might be having a negative impact on the whole service and the rest of the team. Any tips for people in that position at the moment in terms of how to do that kind of with kindness and compassion?
First of all, you have to do it, and you have to be clear on how you do it. I mean, I do think one of the things I've learned is that when I came out as GP training, we weren't taught anything about how to manage staff and correct procedures. Now, I mean, you need to understand how to manage staff and how to go through processes. I personally like to do it in a way that's fair. I think if you're fair, people will always respect that. So I've actually managed, I know two staff members I let go, but I still have a good relationship with. And I think it's because they understood I was fair. And they actually said that. So, you know, when you say something to them, you know, that this is why you're not acting and you explain it clearly. And eventually when I did let them go, I basically sat them down and said, listen, it's ending. I said, but like one of the persons I had been with a long time, and I said, I have gained so much from working with you. You don't know how much you've helped me. It's not working at the moment. It's like a breakup, almost. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that, but it is like a breakup. There was really good times. We, you know, you did some amazing stuff. It's not working out now. We both need to move on. It's not good for either of us. And yeah, we ended up in court and I made a payout, but I actually thought I was quite happy to make a payout because I thought it was fair. This person had put a lot of good work, but it had gone sour.
And how do we kind of blend that with the concept that it's really good to have diversity in a team, that actually people who don't think like us are sometimes bring incredible value, like you've described then, but how do you get that balance right where a certain amount of diversity is right, but that that values also need to be aligned?
Yeah, I must say, first of all, I think having someone who challenges you is, and diversity isn't mean they don't have the same values. So it's just they maybe challenge you on how you're doing it or on your expression of your values. So, you know, you may be doing something and they're saying that's not what you claim you're doing, you know. So for example, you know, the whole issue, one of the classic issues, you know, dilemmas if you want to address marginalization is that staff at the front desk get abused. And how do you manage that? And, you know, there's times when staff would come into me and says, you know, you actually aren't valuing us as staff, in doing this. And I think they're right. So, you know, but they still have the same values. And the problem is if I don't do address this, that will destroy their compassion. And they'll just say, well, you know, damn this. And, you know, they'll start then acting in a way that won't, you know, that will be abusive to patients. So you have to be open to those challenges. That happens all the time. You know, people come to you and say, and anytime they do come, you have to listen to them. Sometimes you disagree with them and you have to go back and disagree with them. Like staff came to me recently where they were finding it very stressful because we hadn't got appointments. And doctors, didn't in the practice didn't fully understand. So I was saying to doctors, listen, you're bringing back patients a lot, which means we're blocking up appointments for new patients. And now staff are finding it very stressful because they can't give appointments. We had some doctors who brought back patients very early. So we sat down as a whole team, and then we decided we would totally change the appointment system, where we would only give out appointments, half the appointments before, and every day half the appointments were kept free. So every morning reception staff had appointments to give out. Now, it was really interesting, as it reduced the DNA rate dramatically. But the most dramatic thing was the reception came back and said, we're now really happy because we're not saying no to patients. We're not constantly having to be negative to patients. So we can say, we've got one for you. That's great. What time do you want? And, you know, that allows the staff then fulfill the vision and mission you want, because they're happy in their work. They're not being oppressed. And I suppose the learning for me is that often it's systems oppress people. So now if you're in a practice where you're receptionist, you know, your doctor tells the receptionist you're not to give any more appointments out today, and someone comes who's sick and they have to then be mean to that person because they've been told. So you have to listen to what people are saying in the thing. It's not necessarily against your values. It's just that it's really important. They have different ways. They're challenging the way you're thinking. And rather than say, well, listen, you know, you have to do your job, sit and listen and try and figure out what is it that you can change.
So from the leader perspective, the people who aren't a great fit, it's got to be about something fundamentally about not sharing the vision or having very dramatically different values. Whereas people who just kind of disagree with you or have a different approach to how to do something, you welcome those. You need those diverse, absolutely, those diverse opinions. And so
you need someone who challenges you. Yeah, definitely.
You've been a leader for quite a long time now. So I'm interested in how you've changed through that time. So have you needed to kind of adapt your leadership style over the years? And if you have, what's led that to happen and how have you done it?
I think there's certain things that I've maintained as a leader throughout, and there's certain things that have changed. I think early on, one thing I learned early on is I'm an initiator. I'm an ideas person. And I tend to have more than one idea at the time. So, and I often, when I'm doing ideas, I'm trying to get two or three things going at the same time. So the classic thing, I've balls in the air, and I'm always waiting for one ball to smash. And, you know, it's waiting for that phone call. Every time I get a phone call from someone, I suddenly think, bloody hell, am I supposed to be meeting them today? And I still get that feeling. So it's that thing of having balls in the air. And in a way, that creates a sense of chaos. And I have to say, I actually love chaos, because I work in a practice with people who are chaotic, and I love going into when it's way too busy and you need to get it sorted out. And so I love that. But the problem is not the people around you, me, don't love that. And so what I learned early on was that I had to develop systems for myself to help organize myself, that didn't leave a trail of chaos behind me. And part of that was recruiting people who were very organized, very different to me. And people, that's in a sense, there were people who would challenge me because, you know, I want to go off and do this. They're saying, hold on, get this sorted out, get the system in place. So that was the first thing, is recruiting those type of people. But two is learning from them on how to be, you know, develop systems, develop governance, get the things, the quality things in. So, you know, I went in and started clinic in homelessness. Like when you start a clinic in homelessness, when I did, you often went in with just a briefcase, and you know, it was you hadn't got very good systems in place. You know, we didn't know how to do bloods, and then you'd gradually build them up. And now I am comfortable going into a place where, like, if there's a sudden new need emerges, like for example, suddenly there's a flood of refugees and there's a hotel up there full of refugees and they've no doctor, I will tell a doctor, go in there into a hotel room and start a clinic. But we are going to bring you a computer. We're going to get you the facilities. We're going to get you the supports that you need to make sure it's high quality. But it's going to take around 4 to 6 weeks. But in the meantime, you need to provide the service. So I've learned to come in with those quality things, and then you develop the governance and the supports that allows people practice to the standard they feel comfortable in. So that's one thing I've learned. Second thing I've learned in is not to try and do everything myself. That was a big learning. And in fact, I think I would say that's one of my skills is allowing people go in and keeping an eye on them to make sure they're able to do it, but letting them do it. So, for example, I have a practice manager at the moment who she's just fantastic. And I just have to go in once a week and we have a short 20-minute consultation meeting where she'll tell me, this is going well, but I just wonder, what do you think about this? I was thinking of doing this. And she may say, I'm having a difficulty with the staff member. And I say, well, listen, do you need me to talk to them? And she may say, yeah, or she may say no. But she runs the place. And she told me she left her last job because the manager was constantly micromanaging her. So I've learned to let people do it, don't do it, but just give them the support they need to do it. Third thing I've learned is, I remember early on when I'd be advocating for something, I would have a tendency to write letters that were angry, saying this needs to be addressed. And occasions going on the press, because when I was involved in disability rights, we would do this. And occasions I would go to the press about things. But are getting up at a conference and giving a talk saying, this is, you know, this is so say the, our health service is called the HSE, where yours is the NHS. Now I get up and say, the HSE isn't doing this. But I learned early on that I was destroying relationships with people. And I'd have to go to those same people looking for funding or support to set up a service. And I wasn't getting the support, not surprisingly, because I'd just been up at a conference the previous week giving out about them. So I've learned to, one is to foster those relationships. Two is give praise, because the health service executive, they're just a large group of people who all want to make a difference. And in other words, praise them where they've made the difference. Where there's problems, bring the problems to them, but do it in a way that you're saying, listen, lads, I know you don't want to be doing this. Let's sort it out. And you still hold on to the option of going to the press, but Jesus, you use it rarely, because it's the nuclear option. It destroys relationships, and that'll prevent other things. That'll interfere with other things you're trying to do. But I think I've really learned to foster relationships. And advocacy for me now is not just about getting up at the hustings. It's also advocacy is about developing collaborations and recruiting people in the system. Because there's lots of good people. I often hear doctors give out about the HSC, and I've seen it at the admin people. The admin people are good people who want to make a difference. Recruit them and use them. Don't give out them and praise them when you can.
I mean, that sounds like an amazing kind of journey that you've been on, from needing to be kind of the angry advocate, you know, get up there, to actually that we're recognizing that these are just individuals who also want to make their difference, and that collaboration and relationships is the key. So that sounds like you've kind of learned to stop, think, make better choices about how you react to certain situations.
Absolutely. And it's also about trusting people. It's about trusting that, you know, I now don't believe there are any bad people of the system. If there's people who are acting in a way that I think is wrong, I usually think it's the system is causing this. So if I hear of a doctor being stigmatized in a hospital, I think that doctor's probably been working way too long hours, and in a really busy system where everyone is overcrowded, you know, stigma gets concentrated. So what we need to do is to help them you know, recenter us where they want to be as doctors. And, you know, and also get them to realize that if they actually work compassionately, they will feel much better about themselves. And in a way, going back to the vision and mission, in a way, it's you're recruiting the people in the system to your vision and mission. And if you have a good vision and mission, they actually is one they want to buy into. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of helping marginalized people, ultimately, most people want to do that. And it's about giving them that vision and mission, and then seeing what is in the system is causing them to react so badly.
I can see that you changed your responses, the choices that you make in your leadership and responses, because you changed your own attitudes. You recognized that they wanted to help and that people were good people and you trusted. Do you find, though, that the attitudes that people have towards the marginalized are often so negative because they make so many assumptions?
Society is full of stigma, and it's often stigma that you don't Absolutely. It's so subtle. So I always give the example is people you say to me is asked, I don't think of you as disabled. And I say, I don't think of myself as disabled. It was a very nice thing to say. And then when I got involved in disability rights, I started to realize that, of course, I'm disabled. So why don't I think of myself as disabled? And that's because I had in my mind, as they did too, that disability is unsuccessful, unattractive, and somehow less human. When you meet someone who doesn't fit that mold, rather than change your stigma, you change the person and they become non-disabled. And that is an example of how, you know, powerful stigma is. You know, even when you meet someone who doesn't fit the mold, you keep your stigma. And how subtle it is, I would never have realized. So to me, there's no such thing as being stigma-free. It's being aware, stigma-aware. And when you're in a system where the only time you meet people from marginalized communities are causing problems. So if you're in a casualty and the only time you meet homeless people is they're the ones who are drunk in the waiting room or they're the ones who are shouting in the waiting room, it just then is going to reinforce because you haven't met them as in a real sense to address. And there's a theory by Allport called contact theory that the only way to address stigma is through genuine, real contact. So in our GP training scheme, for example, we don't bring in homeless people to talk to the trainees. We don't bring in refugees. What we do is we put the trainees to work for 4 months in a service where they have to work directly with the patient on a one-to-one. And we do it with homeless, migrants, prisoners, and travelers as well. And as part of that, we ask them to just to sit down for an hour every few weeks and just write down a non-medical story, just the person's story. And that's how you break down, that's empathy. So when I see people in the hospital doing that, I just think they haven't had that genuine exposure to real contact that can address their stigma. So what we do is, I think the solution to this is education. So that GP training scheme I've set up is to address it in doctors. And what I want to do is, like we started in 2009, and I think it's happening, we're creating a body, enough doctors going around the system who have a different attitude, to start challenging those systems. And I have an amazing colleague, Cliona McCallie, who's now doing inclusion health. She actually applied to be a GP trainee with us. And then she said, actually, I love hospitals. I want to do what you're doing in the hospital. And she went off and found inclusion health. She's an amazing woman. And we now have inclusion health in two hospitals in Ireland with full teams. And these are people who are specifically going to work with marginalized. But one of the things they've done is they've made people who are homeless, who are drug users, feel much more welcome. They're staying on longer in hospital, believe it or not, because they're getting their problems treated, they're not getting readmitted 2 weeks later. So actually the amount of bed days is reduced. But a big thing they've done is they're changing the attitudes of their colleagues. Suddenly consultants want to help the homeless. So we've suddenly got epilepsy services coming out to our clinics rather than we having to send our patients into them. We've diabetic endocrinologists coming out to our clinics. We've dermatologists coming out. And casualty is much more welcoming because we've nurses there who are changing attitudes. So to me is you have to understand it's the system and you need to introduce something into the system to change that.
Yeah.
And I think that's where education makes the difference.
And contact, this thing you just said before about the more people have contact, the more they learn to understand, to trust. I want to take you back to something you said earlier, though, because I was really interested in it, which was that lovely description you gave of your kind of 20-minute chat with the practice manager and then just leaving her to it without the micromanaging, because in my experience, delegation is really difficult to do. And I think there must be some key elements to good delegation. And I'm just wondering what your take on those are.
I do a lot of sailing. I love sailing. When you go out sailing, you have to set up your boat. There's a lot of different things you set up in your boat. You set up like how you set up the sails using shroud with the cars. These are the things that hold up the sail shrouds. You might change the lengths of them. You change the tension. And different wind conditions or wave conditions, you need to change these tensions. And then you also have other controls on the sails that you need to set in certain ways. Now, they're quite complicated, all those controls, but if you go out and you get the controls right for the weather, you actually save the boat sails itself, because if you go out with the wrong things and you're out in weather, say heavy weather, and you're not set up for heavy weather, as you hold the tiller, that manages the rudder, you'll find there's huge pressure on the tiller and you have to be pulling the tiller in. And then if you want to go one way, you have to be pushing it. So there's a huge amount of work and it can be really tiring. If you set your boat up correct, All you have to do is have your hand on the tiller. It's called light touch sailing. You just have your hand on the tiller because it just, the boat sails itself. You've set it up. And that's, to me, is the do with the team. If you've put the work into developing a good team, so you've chosen the right members, you've instilled the values in them, you've given them the support. So take, for example, I said I want my staff to work with people who are on the margins and can be difficult. So we've done trauma-informed care teaching for staff. We've learned, given them sessions on how to manage challenging behaviours. So you've given them all the skills, you've set up the team to be able to deliver the type of service, and you give them the praise. And also a key element of providing the team, there's two key elements. One is obviously helping, making sure they feel valued. That's key. But two is let them develop the way they want to, give them the opportunity. So a guy from a front of house receptionist who, she's just gold. And she's just a patient's lover. She's fantastic. But she wants to become a manager. Now, I didn't want to lose her to reception because she's so good. But I arranged her to do management skills. And then she did management skills. And then she said, I'd like a management role. So we then gave her a role managing a particular service. And now she's really happy. She's still doing reception and she's doing a management role. I have another receptionist who wants to do phlebotomist. Now, neither is a receptionist, but we're giving her a phlebotomy course. Because let them develop. Because, you know, I think that's one of the key things. And if you let them develop, they then appreciate it. So that's all the factors that help you set up your boat, your team in the way. And then you get a manager. And my manager, she's just fantastic. A lot of, she just has to keep her hand on the tiller. And I just have to keep my hand on the tiller. I let her do the job. She's brilliant in terms of systems, in terms of management, but she's also so good at managing people in both ways. In terms of if things are going well, she gives them praise and she gives them support and she helps them develop. And if things are going badly, she has no problem standing up and saying, that wasn't right what you did. She does it in a very respectful way and a very good way. And what I also love is she gets angry because she thinks the service isn't being provided rightly. But she still does it very empathically, but it's out of an anger that this service should be run properly because she's so embedded in the service herself.
Oh no, that's a lot. I really like that sailing analogy. This, if you've set it up right, you can then trust the process. You can trust what you've done, and recognizing people might do something differently from how you would have done it. But actually, that's good. That's worthy of a praise response, not a critical response. I think that analogy is lovely. I'm interested, are there any extra tips that you would say to someone who's in primary care, who's maybe just stepping out on their leadership journey themselves, and things that we might not have covered already? Anything else that you'd want to add?
It's just something I was at a conference and I was talking about this week, and we were talking about what motivates me. I think I'd say there's two things, and it's funny, it's not a popular thing to say. You know, I remember when I was 1982, my first professor of general practice talked about him loving his patients. I remember really liking it, but then, you know, talk about loving your patients is a dangerous sound concept. And also, I'm wary of love too, because as a disabled person, I've worked in organization, I've worked, you know, as a disabled person, we've been oppressed by Christian love for you know, centuries. So, however, I don't know if you go back to the Greek concept of love. Greek, there's seven different types of love, of whom, which eros, which is sexual or, you know, love between partners, is only one. And agape is the love of humanity. And then there's also the love of pragma, which is enduring love. And to me, is if you see love in that wider thing. So, for example, I had a patient not long ago who just burst into tears when they came in. And the reason they burst into tears, I won't go into the reasons why they burst into tears, but they were really bereft. And they were having difficulties in a particular relationship. And I was saying, maybe this is the relationship. By the way, they came from a homeless background. I said, maybe this relationship isn't for you at the moment. And their response was, well, that they are the only thing in my life. There is nothing else in my life. And, you know, I just felt, this connection. And I, the big thing I could offer this person, I couldn't offer them antidepressants. I mean, I could offer them things like getting them housing and support. But the main thing I've offered them is, listen, I'm going to be here for you. I want to see you because I want to help you through this period. And we need to help you get this beyond this. And you can. So it's to give them hope. And I think that endures from your love from patients. I had a patient die last week through to an overdose. And I think, And I was very fond of that patient. And I think that's what drives me now to try and prevent further overdoses. So, you know, it's a love of that love of humanity that it drives me in one sense. And I think drives a lot of doctors, actually, though we're not, you know, because love has become, I think it's due to bloody American romantic movies. We all think love is only one type. And then the second thing is anger. You know, you get angry when you see these things happen. And anger is a very good thing to have, motivate you, but it's also something you have to be careful of. People often run from anger. I think anger is very useful. It gives you energy. It gives you power. And if you use it well, it can focus you. You have to be careful it doesn't destroy. Like I was saying, you don't go in charging into the system, giving out and breaking relationships. But if you use it to motivate you, I can think it uses it very well. And I think both those things actually other people respond to when you harness them, because they have the same feelings. And I've been listening to leaders recently who talk openly about both love and anger. And I think it's actually a thing we don't talk about enough. And please tell me if that sounds way over sentimental or way over the top, because I'd be interested.
No, I mean, I think really what I'm taking from that is that leaders, it's useful if they're aware of the things that motivate them. And if those things are things like love and anger, then used carefully, used kind of respectfully, it can be just incredibly helpful if you know what drives you and what makes you get up in the morning, what makes you go to work.
Yeah.
Do it. So it's helpful for leaders to just kind of know really what, you know, where that motivation comes from. And from what you were saying earlier, the anger seems to be, from your point of view now, it's about this, you're not going to get angry about necessarily individuals. Their response, their actions are usually related to some kind of faulty system, and that's the thing to get the angry with.
And it's also maybe that you don't necessarily have to get angry at something, but it's just you get angry because something happened, you know. Yeah. When a person dies because they're born into poverty, yeah, you're right, it's angry at the system, you're right, it actually is. Yeah. It is angry at something.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Austin. It's been an absolute pleasure. It always is. Thank you. What a great opportunity to talk to Austin today and to hear from him, his perspectives on leadership, particularly in the field that he works within, with marginalized people, which are often a group that people kind of shy away from working with. It's just great to hear. There's some things that really struck me about what he was saying, which made me smile. I loved his self-awareness that he felt that especially in his early leadership, he would leave chaos in his midst. He would love chaos and still loves chaos, but has recognize the fact that he's a piece of a jigsaw of which there are, if you get the other pieces around you who can support the aspects of leading that you might be less good at, then you will make an amazing picture together. And not everybody needs to be the same jigsaw shape. And also that diverse views, they kind of actually help organizations to move on, help you to get a broader perspective. But then if you do have somebody within your midst who absolutely doesn't share the values of your organization, it might be much more useful in the longer term to kind of move them on respectfully. The learning not to do everything himself and to delegate by learning to trust the team, with the fantastic analogy of setting your boat up right so that it almost sails itself. Now that's sounds like a lovely position to be in. And that great journey he's been through of having initially in his early leadership about kind of protesting, almost using anger to protest against people, and then the later recognition that these people are all actually probably want to do the right thing. You'll only change that by collaboration, by building relationships, and by changing things together. So such a great kind of leadership and journey to hear about. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back soon with the next edition of the Leadership Hikers.